Right now, we're being joined by David Tarachuk at the Media Beat here on Robin Hood Radio. David has his own website, themediabeat.us. He's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And we love having him in here on a Friday morning, taking a look at stories that the media is covering. Good morning, David.
Well, hello. Glad to be reporting in again to you, though not from the media capital of the world, New York City, this time, but instead from the great state of Maine. And as ever, I'm glad to be talking with the eagle-eyed Marshall Miles. Lots of news happening, right?
Boy, you know, I woke up this morning, and the first thing I do is I check, I have a BBC news feed, and I see that the former Japanese prime minister was assassinated. I add that to what's going on, what happened with, quote, boat, end quote, Bojo, in England, and the current crisis, basically, with world leaders all around the world. And things are just so crazy now, David.
Well, yeah, it's a tumultuous, newsrooms are in a tumultuous state, of course. There's been this overnight news scramble with the assassination of Shinzo Abe, yeah, the former Japanese prime minister, out of office for some time now because of ill health when he was in office, but still a formidable figure in Japanese politics. But to be assassinated is a rare thing for a Japanese politician. It's a rare thing for anyone in Japan to die at the hands of a gunman, unlike some countries we could name. And of course, the nation is clearly in terrible shock. But one of the things, I suppose, that is illuminated by this shocking killing of a prominent figure in Japan is that it is the very rarity of it. The very fact that it can strike the public there, and those of us who have any knowledge at all of Japan know that it is an extraordinarily rare occasion because, you know, it's a very different society from our own. The very fact that deaths as a result of gunshots are numbered in a couple of handfuls, a dozen at most, a year on average, compared with, what is it in the States, 40,000 or so deaths every year because of guns, the result of gunfire. Very, very different situation. The instability of public life, I suppose, is coming out in different ways in different places. This solitary political shooting in Japan, I don't think there's been one since 15 years ago, I think, in Japan, and that was at the level of a town mayor. The mayor of Nagasaki shot dead, but that was more in the way of a local gangland killing. Japan may have tight controls on guns and so on. It doesn't mean that it doesn't have a crime problem. It certainly does. We know about Japanese gangsters, if only from crime series on TV. But in that case, it was sort of a gangland killing aimed at the politician in charge of the city. But on the whole, life is peaceful. Political life is non-violent, at least non-physically. Not physically violent in Japan, at the same time, the rest of the world roils with political upheaval and discontent, and of course, leaders get their comeuppance in different ways. The other overnight news scramble, of course, is very different from an assassination. It's the peaceful removal, though bitter and unpleasant, of Boris Johnson, as you mentioned, from his top position in the United Kingdom. Finally, inevitably, Bojo, as you use the affectionate term for him, finally gone. And it was such a struggle. But in the end, he had no other way to go except down and out. I noticed the British magazine, The Economist, always very disdainful of Mr. Johnson. Has well, this extraordinarily sharp front page headline with, of course, a cartoon caricature of Bojo. The headline is "Clown Fall." He, you know, he divided people very well. I think some people still like Bojo, but on the whole, it's been an extraordinary fall from grace. A whopping great majority, what he called a colossal mandate from the British public as a whole, just 3 years ago when he rode back into power with a very large parliamentary majority. But now, no friends, it seems, or very, very few friends left in Parliament. And as a consequence, even he could see the signs. It was interesting to see the British coverage. It's always useful, by the way, if you want an understanding of the United Kingdom political scene, to widen your intake of news sources across the broad span of British outlets, The Guardian, on the one hand, for its very sardonic take on the whole thing, something of a left-leaning paper, and interesting to see it changing its headlines as that story developed. We got to the stage of saying of them in a headline describing Boris Johnson as the desperate, deluded prime minister trying to cling on. And then, of course, you know, we got to the point of him resigning. And then, this is a very typical Guardian headline, Johnson's resignation speech. What he said and what he meant. The Guardian gave us both things. Quotes from Boris Johnson, but also a kind of glossary for what is really going on. Like, why he decided to go. His own reasons, stated reasons, are not the same as the politically realistic reasons as the Guardian assesses them.
You know, I was looking at his speech, and then I listened to it. And there's a lot of great... He was gracious and very, very good in a lot of portions of his speech, and then he was obviously out in the fishing waters for other portions, but this is the part that got me. This is the part that brought it all down for me. Quote, I know that there'll be many people who are relieved and perhaps quite a few who will also be disappointed. And I want you to know how sad I am to give up the best job in the world, but them's the breaks.
Them's the breaks, yes, indeed. There was a demotic strain to Boris that, I mean, here I am using his first name again, like people do. I mean, he was such a part of the British scene, seen as, yes, a clown, as The Economist was saying, but, you know, the Brits have, and I include myself as historically, once upon a time, a Brit, only a Brit, I'm now a dual citizen. Yeah, we could regard him as something of a sideshow, as well as a, you know, cunning politician. His humor was often a mask for some pretty sharp, nasty dealing. Yeah. I mean, he just could not resist. I mean, you'll have noticed also in the speech you're quoting from, he just could not resist a stab at the people who had finally put him down. His own cabinet members, in fact. He described them as having a herd mentality. Yeah. Yeah. Suddenly and unaccountably, in Boris's own view, of course, deciding to ditch him. There was a certain amount of gracefulness in his speech, as even the Guardians were prepared to acknowledge, like you're pointing out too. but he couldn't help putting that stab in as well.
The movement of the herd is sometimes, as was a part of the speech that stood out to me as too. Well, you know what's interesting? You can consider when he him a clown and when he was put in as prime minister. But you know, I'll go right now to the Ukraine when they put an actor of a comedian in to be president of the Ukraine. Well, it turns out under pressure, guess what? The man stood up. The man stood up and has proven himself. I mean, those you know, it doesn't mean that if you don't have experience, sometimes the job makes the person.
That's true. And we've had some other unexpected risings to the occasion. Boris, I think, was always known as a cunning operator. You know, for all the affability and you know, and his capability for getting people on his side, mainly the humor helped, I think. But also, he had his finger on a certain pulse, and not a pulse I admire, but a certain pulse in the English, especially strain of. The British psyche. He had very little appeal to the Scots, amongst which I number myself, or the Welsh, or certainly the Irish, whether northern or southern. He had a sort of cavalier attitude to Northern Ireland, where now, of course, those terrible things are coming home to roost in the wake of his Brexit policy. His kind of reckless policy when it came, the part of it that related to Northern Ireland, but he, you know, he was able to touch some of that little Englander feel of people that enabled him to push Brexit through. There's a kind of ugliness to it. There's a kind of xenophobia that runs through the Little England mentality, which he was very good at capitalizing on. But and speaking of little things, by the way, another paper which I would advise people to turn to while they look for coverage of Boris Johnson, the opposite end of the scale of The Guardian, The Telegraph, with which he's been associated in his you know, in his journalistic sidelines. As well over the years. They've had some very interesting insider stories about how the downfall was achieved and you know, which previous supporters turned on him when. And they're reporting, excuse me, they've been reporting overnight it's only speculation, I suppose, except that, you know, there are some facts to support it. But one of the reasons for Boris digging in his heels as much as he did for so long has been his desire to still be prime minister at the end of this month, when his wedding to Carrie, the mother of his latest child, was planned to be celebrated with a huge party at Chequers, the extraordinarily beautiful Elizabethan mansion that is the official residence of British prime ministers. That, they say, or are heavily hinting at least, is the reason that he didn't want to go, and that he made such a clear point of wanting to, you know, stick around as a caretaker kind of prime minister until his successor is elected. Most members of the Parliamentary Conservative Party, though, are working very hard on the sidelines right now. Again, the Telegraph has its ear to the ground about all of this to make sure that departure policy, the departure procedure, is speeded up considerably, and that he goes a lot quicker than he hopes. He's hoping to stay on until the fall. They are hoping that the backbench, the rank-and-file committee of parliamentary members of the Conservative Party will be able to organize in such a way as they get rid of him much quicker than that.
Anybody, any leading candidates?
Well, it's a broad field at the moment. I think there are no obvious successes. That's the other thing that leaders like Boris Johnson ensure. On the other hand, my private tip would be to look out for Ben Wallace, a kind of down-to-earth, pragmatic politician who's currently the defense secretary. And has not been shuffled around from different, you know, between different posts inside the cabinet the way that Johnson has done with several people. I mean, he was reshuffling right until the last minute, and this caretaker regime that's supposed to stay in place for a so-called smooth transition is something that has got Boris Johnson's fingerprints all over it, but unchanging amongst it, and of course suddenly much more prominent because of the support for Ukraine that you've been mentioning. Ben Wallace has got something of a spotlight on him, and he's a canny enough politician to take advantage of it, I think.
Let's go to this country where Joe Biden really has disappointed a lot of Democrats, and I'm not just talking about your liberal Democrats and progressive Democrats, even conservative Democrats. He's done something to stand up and show that he's got some power, and that he's signing an executive order which is going to protect abortion access, and it's got a lot of different keys to it. But I think the main problem that Joe Biden has is that when he puts a plan together and then it goes before the House running, the Supreme Court steps in on a lot of the executive orders that Joe Biden has gone forward with.
Well, he's in a difficult position, of course. The Supreme Court's decisions coming as they did at the end of the term in the June, as happens every year, there's been almost a tumultuous succession of judgments that so palpably demonstrate that this is not your grandfather's Supreme Court. This is an activist and conservative, of course, with a super majority on the conservative end. It places it would have placed any Democratic president in a difficult position. Abortion, of course, is one of those keystone issues that certainly for the Democrats caused not only fury at the opposite side of the argument, but fury amongst themselves about how much their leaders have prepared for change. The change to Roe v. Wade was very obviously coming, and we've known almost the word by word drafting of it in plenty of notice because of the leak from Sam Alito's drafting of it. That particular Supreme Court justice who clearly was the moving force on the conservative side. the fact that it had been telegraphed for so long, it was just the inevitable culmination in the long run, of course, of 50 years of campaigning, but very particularly over the last 5 years, 10 years. And so you can see why Democrats themselves are disappointed with Biden now reduced to somewhat limited, responsive, reactive steps that are limited to the few levers he's able to use with executive action. It'll be interesting to see if he goes as far as to mandate federal institutions like the extraordinarily powerful and widespread network of medical facilities in the Veterans Administration, if that could be brought into play to provide unfettered access for women to get abortions in the facilities of the VA, that would be something that would I think get a lot of support on the Democratic side and perhaps reclaim for him some of the some of the respect that I fear he may have lost in not having properly prepared or fully and effectively prepared in advance for what was an obvious judgment coming from the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I've taken a closer look since this whole decision came down. Out of the 50 states of the Union, and I wanted to see if it would hold true. The split in this country is amazing. 13 states have opted to keep their abortion laws intact. 13 states have opted to restrict abortions. And the other 24 states are doing nothing. Now, guess where most of the pro and con states are? The pro states are the East Coast and West Coast, and the con states are the South, the middle of the country, the Southern middle of the country, and the Northern middle of the country. It breaks down exactly to political lines.
The usual pattern.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, it's and it adds to the the ongoing discussion, which is getting stronger and stronger in political circles now. We've got a sense of, I don't want to over-exaggerate it, but it has the feel of that secessionist talking that historically preceded the Civil War. We're not heading towards a civil war, I don't think, but there's an awful lot of bitterness built up between, we know the bitterness is just in the air, but the fact that a new polity is in the making here. The reds and the blues are so clearly divided on the map, and there's a sense of solidarity on each side, and of course hostility between them. Biden himself put his finger on it when he said that he sort of gave this cautionary warning that we better watch out for the first occasion when a woman is arrested for crossing a state line in order to get the medical care she needs. It's that kind of heightened temperature that I think is looking very dangerous in terms of a stable political way of life. We seem to be throwing away the concept of decent, if you like, ordinary decent political discourse, and turning everything into a conflict.
It's amazing times we live in here. We've got the latest black person that was shot. He was handcuffed, and why handcuffed?
And many
yeah,
shots. Of
yeah,
that.
60,
yes,
60.
Another
yeah.
horrific scene.
Yeah,
I think we can't let the week pass without registering. I mean, it was registered at the time, but let's underline it too. The gruesome symbolism. Yeah. Of United States citizens being shot dead and injured too, many of them, 7 shot dead, a couple of dozen or more injured, amid all the red and white and blue razzmatazz of Independence Day. That, again, was something that was horribly predictable. The number of shootings I mentioned earlier in comparison with Japan, the number of shootings in the United States has gotten to the point where you've almost got a law of averages saying that sooner or later, and sooner rather than later, that all-American atrocity of a gunman on the rampage would occur on our national day of celebration. And now it's happened, and now we see. And yet, are we going to have any resolution of this problem? In all likelihood, not. The same argument will start again. We have one piece of new gun legislation passing of a limited nature out of Congress last week, and the president signing it into law. And everyone recognizes it is extremely limited. And, of course, the gun lobby is marshaling its forces to press it to defend against any further extension of gun control. So, we've got this stasis established yet again over this dreadful issue, which makes us, the most retrograde kind of society in, advanced society in the world. And it can't really go without without comment that we have this kind of horror besmirching our day of supposed celebration, July 4th.
Always interesting to talk with you, David. We'll see what the world brings us next week and the media brings us.
Yes, indeed. Talk to you then.
Take care. David Tarachuk with The Media Beat. You can find David, of course, at his own website, themediabeat.us, themediabeat.us.